We would like to begin this podcast by acknowledging that the land on which we record is the occupied, traditional, and unceded territory of the Stalo First Nation.
And I think in Canada these days, so many consumer goods have, on the one hand, we see inflation. On the other hand, we see a real proliferation of kind of low-rate goods, especially clothing. And people think like, wow, how can they be so cheap? And that's a good question, right? It may be that workers aren't being treated right or aren't being paid well, or maybe at all, at some layer of those supply chains.
Welcome to the Ending Poverty Together podcast. I'm Shalane, and we're here to discuss big questions about poverty in bite-sized ways. Andrei Sachenko currently works as the Regional Vice President of Forced Labor Programs in Asia-Pacific, leading IJM's programs working with governments and civil society partners to demonstrate effective models to eradicate forced labor from key industries and recruiting corridors in Southeast Asia. Andrei's last post was Regional Director for IJM in Southern India and previously spent 10 years in Thailand and the Philippines leading teams fighting sex trafficking. Before joining IJM, Andrei was a lawyer in Seattle. And Andrei, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Shalane. It's great to be here.
And you are joining today from Thailand, aren't you?
True enough. Yeah, Bangkok, Thailand.
Yes. Okay. Well, I appreciate you getting up early to be here and to have this conversation. We are going to be chatting about a difficult topic today. I want to be looking at the forced labor. And I think maybe a great place that we could start is perhaps by having you provide some terminology or some definitions, because I know a lot of different terms get used, like forced labor or modern slavery. So how about if we start there and see where we go?
Yeah. So, I mean, what we're really talking about, bottom line, what we're really talking about is bad work, exploitative work that someone is prevented from leaving. And so, you know, we could have different types of exploitation, right? People could be not paid or physically or sexually assaulted. Or there could be abusive working conditions, and people could be held in different ways too, right? By violence or threats, by debt bondage or intimidation, withholding of their ID documents. So, I mean, that's the nuts and bolts of what it really looks like on the ground. And then how it gets applied to these different terms, that is a result of different legal frameworks or UN conventions or different countries' laws. And sometimes how different organizations prefer to put labels, right? So, you know, one is modern slavery. And that's something that some organizations really like to use that because it helps put a harsh or a serious term on something that's happening today. And people think, wow, is there slavery happening today? And yes, there is. There are modern forms of slavery today. And that's important. Sometimes we use human trafficking. Because the word trafficking implies commodification, right? It implies that people are being turned into a commodity. And so that word is appropriate. And also now there are lots of laws around the world on human trafficking. And so we use that. And forced labor is also a term that comes from international conventions. The ILO has a forced labor convention from 1930. So it's also a little more intuitive, forced labor. So a little bit about the terms. Don't want to get too far down that rabbit hole, Shalane, but happy to, you know, my lawyer past will geek out on terms if you let me.
Right. Okay. Well, I think it's helpful to bring the context and what you just said in terms of the really horrific kind of working conditions that some people experience is at the root of all of these terms. What are the countries that IJM is currently working on protecting people from forced labor in Southeast Asia?
Well, in Southeast Asia, we are working in Thailand, Cambodia, Myanmar, Malaysia, and Indonesia on a program, kind of coordinated program that I'm serving in. And we're doing that because we want to focus on the places where workers are most abused or most in abusive working conditions, and mm-hmm. where we can partner with governments to help see increased protection. What we know around the world is that this forced labor or modern slavery persists and goes at higher rates wherever laws are not being consistently enforced. And so it's those places where we feel like there's a real advantage to putting extra efforts and partnering with communities and with governments and with survivors themselves to see increased protection for workers in those most vulnerable spaces.
Mm-hmm. One of the countries that FH Canada works in is Cambodia, and the communities that we work in are very close to the Thai border. So there's a lot of migration between Cambodia and Thailand. And I would imagine, I know from hearing stories, that increases the vulnerability for people when they are migrant workers and they're crossing a border, perhaps illegally, to find work in another country. How would you speak to that?
100%, Shalane. That's absolutely right. I mean, the most vulnerable people that we see in Southeast Asia, in our countries, and I think around the world, are, well, first of all, workers in poverty in their countries at all. People in poverty are just generally much more vulnerable to all kinds of different violence, including workplace violence. And migrant workers also have an increased vulnerability because they're operating outside their own countries. You know, they're operating in spaces with different language where justice systems aren't designed to protect them, where they may be afraid of authorities, and they may be experiencing different kinds of prejudice or different kinds of exploitation and lack of access to rights.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I think sometimes when we sit in Canada, we can recognize that there's issues that are significant within our own country. We don't always necessarily make a connection to what's happening in Southeast Asia in some of these kinds of circumstances and how that actually connects to us here in Canada. And maybe, dare I even say, how some of our choices and behaviors in Canada actually participate in some of these things happening. I don't know. Is that fair to say?
Well, totally fair. And I think that's the same for all of us. And when we're talking about forced labor, especially in the private economy, many of the products that get made by people who are in these forced labor jobs actually end up in our households, right? Consumer goods, food products. Now, these are some of the kinds of products that are often made with inputs from people who are in forced labor situations or child labor situations. And that's true in Canada as well as for me here in Bangkok when I am going out to purchase things for my own household. And it's hard to figure out what might have been produced by forced labor or child labor and what might not have been. You know, the reality is that goods that we consume are made up of tons of different inputs, right? Like, for example, a shirt that I'm wearing might have lots of different pieces of material in different threads and buttons and zippers that might all have been sourced from different factories or subcomponents. And then the raw materials would also be produced by different people, and it would all be assembled in some factory and then packed and shipped. And all of the different people who worked on all of those different subcomponents are part of what we call a supply chain or a value chain. So it's really tough to unpack where all of those workers might have come from and what might be all of their working conditions. And so that's just tough to get your head around when you're just talking about one item, let alone all the different things that we consume from all different sort of sources, right? And we're used to thinking about what's cheap, what's going to meet our budget. And I think in Canada these days, so many consumer goods have, on the one hand, we see inflation. On the other hand, we see a real proliferation of kind of low rate goods, especially clothing. And people think like, wow, how can they be so cheap? And that's a good question, right? It may be that workers aren't being treated right or aren't being paid well, or maybe at all at some layer of those supply chains.
Wow. I actually just this week spoke in four different grade six classes. And we were talking about some of these kinds of issues. And so I had the kids check the tags on their shirts. And in one of the classes, 9 different countries were represented for where the clothing came from. So in Canada, we consume things from all over the world.
Very true. And, you know, that's just the place where the textile was finally put together. That doesn't even represent where all of the raw materials and subcomponents of that shirt or those shirts came from. And it doesn't represent the places where the workers themselves came from, right? If the factory if it came from Thailand, it's quite likely that the workers in the factory were from Cambodia or from Myanmar. It's also quite likely that the cotton or other material came from a completely different country, which also may have had migrant workers from a completely additional country, right? So the scope is huge. Now, one thing about Canadian consumers is that a few years ago, World Vision Canada actually conducted some research to try to figure out, well, how much consumer goods or how much material that Canadians consume is coming from risky places. And what they found was that actually a staggering amount of it was coming from risky places. And of course, they weren't investigating individual products, but what they were saying was that they were trying to overlay data that we have publicly about where are higher rates of forced labor prevalence, where are places where this is occurring against workers, and then where are the imports coming from into Canada. And so what they found was that over the previous decade, the amount of imports from risky places had gone up by 50%. And it was at $48 billion of imports from riskier environments around the world. And so those were from across electronic sectors to textiles to food products, latex gloves, all kinds of products that they identified. So it's definitely something that is a reality for Canadian consumers.
And when you identified the 5 countries that you're working in right now, I'm assuming that those are 5 countries that are in that riskier area.
Certainly. And not all for all products or industries, you know, definitely these countries are all trying to do something with worker protection. And that's the reality of it, is that countries that around the world have worker protection laws, have anti-human trafficking laws, have anti-forced labor laws, and even action plans in the governments. But what we find is that where enforcement isn't consistently done on behalf of the most vulnerable people, there will be exploitation. And that's what IJM programs are about, is walking with survivors, walking with the most vulnerable communities, and working with governments to try to improve enforcement of laws in ways that are victim-centric, so that victims can trust and rely on those formal mechanisms, get help, and that criminal operators in those supply chains are given a clear message, hey, this won't be tolerated. You can't get away with this anymore. Because we've seen that when that kind of enforcement can happen, you know, real change gets made for those most vulnerable communities.
I can't help but pick up on some of the language that you use of walking with the most vulnerable. That's so in keeping with who we are at Food for the Hungry. Maybe expand a little bit on that. I would just love to learn more about the programs, and maybe you even have some stories to tell if you feel like that's appropriate to share.
Yeah, great. Of course. I mean, you know, when we're talking about walking with, and I mentioned a few different groups involved, because they all have an important role to play, right? And if we first talk about the survivors, survivors themselves, of course, start a journey far before exploitation and aren't defined by that. Right. But usually at IJM, we might come into contact with them either during or just after an exploitation experience, right? And so then it's important for them to have the tools and the support around them to go through these difficult processes, right? Which sometimes they're certainly not prepared for. They may not have knowledge of the process. They may not have someone to help explain or move them through in a way. And so that's something we try to do is empower and equip them to move through these processes in a way that is empowering and dignifying for them.
Can I just ask a question? How do you come in contact with them? How might somebody who's a survivor actually come in contact with somebody from IJM?
Well, we put our staff and partners right in the most vulnerable communities where we know that exploitation is happening. And so then they typically will refer cases to us, or we'll hear of them firsthand.
We might send people out into the field to do some interviews in places where we suspect that there might be something happening. We also have tip lines and hotlines and partnerships with different organizations. And, you know, it isn't always IJM, our own staff. We have local partners that we work with. And of course, what we're trying to do is work our way out of a job in the places where we are. So we want to be strengthening government staff and offices also. Those are also in the communities that are most vulnerable, right? Through local local police stations or local labor inspectors or even other frontline officials, right? Schools or hospitals or health clinics or fishermen centers, if we're talking about fishing industry or different kinds of frontline local organizations or faith groups or community leaders. These organizations we want to see be able to detect where there may be cases of forced labor happening and then know what to do with those cases in a way that's victim-centric. So when we say walking with, we mean, you know, case by case, working on different examples so that we can show, you know, what does good look like and we can work that out together for a survivor. Because it may not be the same one-size-fits-all solution for every survivor or every community.
Right.
And then for government, you know, that looks like something a little bit more formal, right? Systems, processes, standard operating procedures, down to the nitty-gritty of like, what forms are we using? What are the definitions and the different indicators of forced labor that a labor inspector might use if they were going to go into a factory to find out, hey, you know, is this look like a problem? Is there something that's worth digging into a little bit deeper here? Those different approaches for the different people that we're walking with. And we do that over a period of years, right? Because we want to see, okay, where are the spots where cases are falling through the cracks? Where are the spots that cases aren't being detected or that justice isn't being served, where victims aren't getting compensation? And so what we do is we work on cases and we work on the processes and we build trust and confidence in those systems and processes. And then over time, momentum builds, right? And as some positive cases start coming through, then survivors begin to say, hey, actually, these things can work. This system can work for people like us. And we can send cases in and refer them to these local partners and we get compensation. And we can advocate for our own rights and we can see that that's possible, right? And as that happens, then also the system just gets more familiar with handling these cases. And also government officials begin to say, yeah, actually, we're doing a pretty good job of this. And this is something we can be proud of and actually use as a value add. And governments actually like that because, you know, it's a value add economically to be able to say, you know, this is a safe labor environment that investors can really bank on, right? So for economic development purposes, having a protected workforce is actually a real big advantage.
So I kind of took us on a little bit of a different trail, but I would like to come back to the experience of a survivor. They've come in contact with somebody from IJM. They've maybe been referred through one of the different agencies that you talked about or one of the different streams that they might get connected. What would their experience be? What kinds of ways are you connecting with them or what are you connecting them to? What does that look like?
Yeah, let me give you an example, or let me just refer to one specific person. And I think it's good you referenced your recent trip to Cambodia because this young man, and we'll call him Pana, actually migrated to Thailand from Cambodia, an area not too far from the border, when he was 16 years old back in 2018. Now, that's a young age, and we don't see a lot of child migrants, but that was his story. And he came from a farming community and his family farm was not doing great, wasn't bringing in quite enough income for the family. And so they had heard stories about, you know, the key to the better life being, you know, a Thailand job, right? And so he was a young, optimistic, strong man. And he thought, thought this is my chance to help my family. And so I went with 30 other Cambodians across the border with this recruiter and was brought to a fishing pier. And so, you know, he got on the boat along with most of those other young men and went out onto that boat and, you know, thought, okay, well, let's make this happen. The promised salary was real good. And and he thought, well, just a couple of months here and that'll help. And then we can see where that takes me. Mm-hmm. So it turned out the job was really bad, Like he was working more than 12 hours a day. He was fed. They were just fed a couple times, times a day, usually not enough food to eat. They were often seasick. They were always exhausted. But if they fell asleep many times, the captain or supervisor would throw salt water on them, throw seawater on them to wake them up. So they were sort of just in this perpetual state of high alert and trauma in many ways, right? Mm-hmm. And it's dangerous work. And so,
I bet.
You know, he's they're going through all of that. There were also intimidation. He was afraid of violence on the boat all the time. But he slogged through and he got back to land and he actually kept going back out for more trips because he thought, you know, what else is there? This was
the best opportunity
that he felt he could try for, and he made it through. And so he thought, well, let's go back. He wasn't earning the salary that was promised. They were telling him that the salary had actually been changed and that they had been deducting a lot. And so they said, well, you'll get the payment later on if you keep working. So he thought, well, okay, I'll put in a year. And then they're saying that if I put in a year, I'll get a salary. And they'll send me home. I can go back home and bring this to my family. So it was getting close to a year, and he got on another boat and he went out, and it was the same horrible working conditions. And so one day he was kind of out near the machine where the nets were pulled back in, right? And this, he had his hand kind of on the nets, and someone flipped a switch on the machine and his hand was just badly mangled, just a brutal injury. And he blacked out, but his hand was, terribly disfigured and injured. And so they actually did take him into the hospital, but they were not able to save his hand. His hand had to be amputated. And so, here's Pagan, a year into this work with now one well-functioning hand. So he actually even tried to go out on the fishing boat again to work because they were still not promising him any salary unless he finished out what he had said he would do. And so he went out onto the boat, but he couldn't do it. There wasn't a way he could actually do his work with one hand. And so, he was taken back to Cambodia and still, in the end, they paid him nothing. They had told him about all these deductions that were supposedly there, the new salary rate and the expenses that they had to incur for him, and said, wow, finally, it doesn't even cover the cost of your passport, so we're just not going to give you any money. So he's dealt back in Cambodia with really absolutely crushed, right? He had these dreams of things being better, but instead he comes back with nothing. And, now he's a person with a disability.
Right, permanent.
And so struggling even more. So, that's a realistic situation for many migrant workers, and where dreams just aren't realized like they thought, right? And so IJM came in contact with Pagan back in not too long after he had come home, 2019, 2020. And we heard about it. We interviewed him, and we learned more information about the case. And so we took it on and helped him file a complaint on the Cambodia side against the trafficker who had sent him over. And eventually he was, in fact, the trafficker was, in fact, convicted and in prison for a period of time. The judge gave a really poor compensation award, something like $240, which is ridiculous. So we appealed it and eventually got a $5,000 judgment, which I think is even still not great, but certainly much, much better. And felt good. Now, an ongoing problem is that debt collection against traffickers in Cambodia is still a big challenge. And so he have not been able to collect that compensation award. But I think his experience out of it, according to him, was that he felt much more optimistic and hopeful moving forward, because of that experience of having been able to stand up for himself and tell his story and his experience and have that validated through you know, a judgment and a compensation award. And, you know, we'll continue working on that compensation award and other ones. We also were able to move him through a process we call survivor services or aftercare. And that includes, you know, a whole range of potential engagements, psychosocial work, protection, looking at a holistic view of what takes a survivor to remain free from exploitation. And for Pana, and his family, that included some education, included some housing support, and it included some support to start a small business. So he's actually now starting a small grocery store and continues to do his best to work on the farm. And you know, he says you know, amazing things. He says, like, when I lost my hand, I'm going to read a quote from him because I wrote it down. He says, "When I lost my hand, I lost all my dreams. But now I feel there is still hope," which is
that's beautiful.
Actually miraculous, right? That someone in his circumstance would say that they felt that there is still hope moving forward. And so I think that's really wonderful. And it's something that we try to carry with us as well, that in the middle of all the difficulty and setbacks and frustrations and ongoing brokenness, but we do see progress. We do see also reasons for hope.
I appreciate you giving a really specific example because it really does illustrate the collaboration that's happening, the holistic approach, and there's something about understanding how it's individuals who are experiencing this, and to bring that face, that name to someone and to understand that story, I think is just really, it's really insightful and helpful. So thank you.
Thanks, Shalane. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Both the individual stories and the statistics are important. There are 27.6 million people every single day experiencing forced labor. It is true that 40% of returned Cambodian migrant workers have reported to IJM in a study in 2022 that they had experienced forced labor as part of their migration journey. So the numbers are staggering, right?
They are staggering.
And actually the impact on individual lives is equally as staggering. But the flip side of that is that when there can be change, like in Tamil Nadu, India, a couple of years ago, when we found that on an end-line study, 82% less people were experiencing forced labor crimes compared to just 7 years earlier on a baseline study. I mean, that is equally as mind-blowing, right? And for a person like Pana, who can say that there's still hope following an experience of such, you know, life-destroying violence, that's also remarkable and courageous and inspiring. So I think we can try to hold those realities at the same time, knowing that there's great amount of work to do, but that we have seen success, that we have tools in our hands, and that we are working with communities and survivors who have great courage and who are not going to stop moving forward. So we won't either.
Well, and when you see those success stories, when you see that people have had the opportunity to live a different life, and you see the resilience and the, like you said, the courage and the hope that people have, that has to be a motivation as you move through all of the other pieces that are so disturbing and so upsetting.
Yeah, I mean, 100%.
We need to have hope.
We certainly do. And I mean, for me, you know, it's been 20 years in this work, Shalane, and that's a long period of time. And I wouldn't have known how it would be possible to do it like that. And but it has been 1 year at a time and one month at a time. And I think hope has been an important part, that energy moving forward, real hope that's grounded in the idea that things can change and that there is power for change, and that walking with communities and with people who are trying to do the right thing and doing our best to be people who are move forward, you know, with love and courage, trying to move forward. And it's great to have partners like Food for the Hungry also. I know our IJM Canada team loves to work and support all of our IJM programs all around the world and collaborate with organizations like FH Canada. So we love these collaborations, and we love the communities in of work in the different countries where we are. So thank you also for your work.
Yes, thank you. It's a privilege. Andre, as I expected, our time is gone. I knew it would go quickly. Is there anything else that you want to add before we wrap up? Was there anything else you were hoping to speak to?
You know, I guess just bringing it back to Canadian consumers and Canada, you know, we have been really encouraged to see how the Canadian government is eager to put more steps in place to guard Canadian consumers and to do better with Canadian supply chains. And so last year, a new Modern Slavery Act was passed and it went into force earlier this year. And the government's, you know, hopefully will be allocating more resources to enforcing that so that there's some guards and protections against goods made with forced and child labor from coming into the Canadian market. And I think it's great for Canadians to be aware of that and to be participating in that and asking their government to do Canada's part in fighting against that exploitation around the world. So just encourage listeners to engage in those processes. And of course, also to keep supporting in whatever ways good organizations that are helping communities of need and workers and communities around the world. Thanks, Shanae.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here, Andre. I really appreciate you and appreciate the work of IJM. So grateful that you would spend time with us today.
Thanks so much, Shalene. Great to be here.
To explore what your next steps could be or to find out more about FH Canada and IJM, start by checking out fhcanada.org/resources.